maybe you're going through a leadership transition and you just need somebody to keep the ship up and help you with the search, you know, we can come in and we'll help you interview and backfill and train, and then we'll fade out into the sunset.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Nick Bellotta from Bellotta & Co. CPAs, and we're going to talk about something which someone said to me recently is kind of an out-of-date concept. I was trying to figure out what fund accounting was, and someone else said, oh yeah, they used to teach us that back in the 80s in accounting school, but it's kind of, you know, fallen out of favor. But I found someone who's maybe got a different take on that, and that's Nick. And he's going to tell me about the power of fund accounting when it comes to storytelling, something that has also kind of fascinated me. How come the numbers-driven people should be so interested in telling stories? So Nick's going to explain that to me too. If you're interested, come along for the ride. Nick, before we get started, tell us something about you that not many people know.
I think something not a lot of people know about me is I was a non-traditional student when I finally went back for my bachelor's and master's in accounting. And in that time, in the interim, I was a motorcycle technician. So I went to American Motorcycle Institute. I got certified to work on Ducati motorcycles by Ducati North America. And then I had a short stint at Ducati Miami as a technician for them. I was 19 years old, living in Miami. And then after that, I ended up transitioning up to Daytona Beach, and I was a technician at a Honda Suzuki Yamaha shop before working back into retail and then eventually back into accounting and then a professional career. But yeah, it was a really interesting time getting to break down engines and work on bikes.
I've heard you many years ago, there was a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I don't know if you've ever heard that book.
No, I have not. I'll have to look it up though.
Okay, well, I'll have to look it up too, because I don't think I've read it. But everyone, all the cool kids talk about how, you know, how Zen and how all the life lessons in it. I was hoping you could tell me, but we'll figure that out. So tell me, sounds insanely cool, very teenagery thing to do, run away and start making bikes, right? Or fixing bikes. What did you say, you know, did you learn anything from that, or did you just have a hell of a good time that you still use today?
Yeah, both. You know, I learned a lot of technical knowledge. You know, literally am comfortable breaking down an engine, working on brakes, working on whatever I need to. So I think I learned a lot of technical skills. And then it was really interesting when I was in the Miami shop, there was one other tech. And that other tech, he only spoke Italian and Spanish, and I only spoke English. So we had to learn how to communicate and work together in a different way. And I think it really learned me to connect with people outside of just language. And it was a really interesting time during that. But then I also learned that I needed to be around a support network. You know, I was 19, living alone in Miami, working 6 days a week at the shop. And I didn't have a whole lot of time for friends and family. And I ended up getting depressed pretty quick. And I acknowledged that, realized that, and then moved back up to Daytona Beach, where I had some friends and family. But yeah, Miami was not for me as a lone 19-year-old kid.
Sounds like you can get a lot of trouble in a 19-year-old kid living alone in a big city like that if you wanted to. And let me ask about the non-traditional education, did you call it? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. You know, to me, that means taking a break. So a lot of kids will just go through school, right? They'll do elementary, they'll do middle, they'll do high school, and then they'll go right into college. I did that. Like, I lasted a semester and a half. I was going to dual major in accounting and MIS. And after a semester and a half at Huston College up in Bangor, Maine, I thought I was too cool for school and dropped out and did the motorcycle thing. And then trying to figure out where I could go with that career, and then worked into retail, and it was the same thing. Like, how could I get into more corporate loss prevention type roles without a formal education and background at a college level? And I wasn't getting a whole lot of traction. So that non-traditional route kind of gave me, I think, a skill set more on customer service, team organization, working with people. And then it allowed me the time to work backwards and really architect the career that I wanted to have. So I got to study professions, study, you know, quality of life, study the work. And then that's when I really made the decision to pursue accounting, and by working backwards on what was the type of career that I wanted to have.
Now, that's interesting because I think that was an unlock for me maybe 11 years ago. For me, I was a technician as well, a programmer. So when you're a technician, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Like, so I was a programmer. I was trying to run around, make software for everyone, hoping someone would pay me. And then someone, a guy called Jason Cohen, gave a talk I saw, and it was all about like designing your ideal business. Kind of the same idea, design your ideal life, I guess. Sounds like you sound like, okay, well, I could have all these lives out here or different way. What do you want? What do I want this business to give me rather than what do I want to do, you know, which was a different way of thinking about it. So you landed on accountancy. So you tried motorcycle technician. Why? What are the attributes of that skill set that you like? Is it, tell me, is it the reliability? Is it the fact you'll always be able to have a job? Is it the fact that you'll pick up girls at parties when they hear what you do? Like, what's the draw?
From the motorcycle tech point of view?
Well, from you could have done anything, right? It sounds like you were quite intentional about what you were going to do. You picked accountancy. Yeah, why?
You know, I think it's a discipline where you get to learn business from a unique point of view. So you get to learn business from a technical point of view at first and kind of almost compliance focused, like what do you have to do to keep the lights on? And, you know, as you're starting out in your career, you're not using a whole lot of judgment yet. You're learning the basics, maybe how accounts payable works, how to reconcile cash, how to look at fixed assets. But as you grow that skill set, what I realized is it gives you an unlock, and that unlock is you learn how to architect the business's future. So you not only get to kind of help with the compliance reporting, but when you understand the levers that the leadership and the management teams pulled to make that history happen, then you can start to then educate and influence and design a future where you pull the same levers, you know, as you need to, or maybe you design new levels depending on what's going on. And I think that's where it really excited me is I get to always, you know, like you said, always have a job, but I get to create what I want to do. And I've had the benefit of having a pretty unique career and, you know, starting out in public accounting, transitioning into corporate accounting, a couple different roles throughout that period, and then ended up starting my own shop just about 2 years ago now. And it's been a blast and I've never had as much fun as I'm having now. And I don't know a whole lot of people that can say that. And I don't know if I knew when I did look back and create, you know, that desire to become a CPA and have a career in that field, that I knew how much fun I was going to have. I was a little bit more focused, I think, on the stability and the security that I thought it could provide. But now I get to kind of have it all because now I get to create our future where I'm building a future for my business and my team. And it's a ton of fun.
You referenced a team there. What sort of team have you built so far?
Yeah, you know, I've been fortunate where I've worked with some really great people along the way. And, you know, I've maintained that network and that relationship over the years. So we've got about 10 people now, including me. You know, a handful of them are part-time. We'll grow those roles into full-time roles kind of as the firm grows. But we're building out a full-service remote firm where you can still feel like you're getting that small touch firm atmosphere. So you're going to get a small dedicated team, you know, from a consistent group of people. And there's a lot of pressure right now in our industry to offshore, and we're not doing that. So you're also getting a dedication to, you know, have a local team here, primarily in Washington State, that's servicing your account. And that's a little bit about what we're doing. But yeah, right. Different levels. So 3 different practice areas, probably about 3 people in each right now, assurance, tax, and advisory.
Very good. So I'll ask you a little bit more about your practice at the end, but I want to bring you to the day of your funeral. And, you know, they say, well, hey, Nick, you know, he started off in motorcycle repair. He ended up building whatever Nick Belletta, CPA and Co. turns into. Let's say, maybe you can tell us at the end what that's going to be. But in the middle, what thus far has been the biggest sort of commercial success that you've had? What's the thing you're known for, if you like?
I think it's a unique, varied career. So I got to work on really technical accounting things at Starbucks, hypothetical liquidation at book value accounting, helping account for solar tax equity investments and help with due diligence throughout that process. And then I got to lead an SEC reporting team when I was at Starbucks. And that's where I learned the art of storytelling and how, you know, large corporations look at numbers and events and really using that to tell a concrete story that's cohesive and linked together throughout that organization's kind of talk track. And then, you know, I went over to Zulily, and when I went to Zulily, it was going to be a project-based role, but it was a project-based leadership role. So I went in to lead a team of about 20 professionals as director of accounting and finance. But outside of just picking that up and running with the day-to-day for helping the company get through the filings, we rolled up into Curate Retail at the time. So we were publicly traded. So we were going into our quarterly reporting cycles. I was there to help with some due diligence. So we were selling the company from Curate Retail to private equity. And I got to help lead the financial due diligence for the sell side team. And I learned a lot through that process. And I think that combined with a lot of my background in construction when I was early in career in public accounting really positioned me well for what I've been able to do now. So our advisory arm, I've been able to help a couple different business owners work through buy side due diligence where there one was a old business owner. He had sold a prior company and he was looking to reinvest in a new one. So I helped him buy another small general contractor. And then we helped a minority GC owner buy out a majority owner, go through a small due diligence project that then turned into an advisory to help them kind of stand up controllership and replace a team.
So let me double click on this storytelling thing, right? So it's always kind of fascinated me that the really seemingly high-end finance controllers or CFOs, they pride themselves on their storytelling. And yet, on the other hand, I thought that accounts were supposed to stand by themselves and make you comparable to everyone else. And, you know, basically they should tell their own story. So square that circle for me. Who gives you the story? Are you told, hey, this is what I want the books to say, go make the story? Or what do you mean when you say storytelling?
Yeah. So I think storytelling high level, let's start with that and then unpack it a little bit. I can keep it shorter, but storytelling is guiding a listener to what you want them to hear. So whether results are good or bad, whether you have headwinds or tailwinds, whether you have significant negative press or not, you figure out how to, I don't want to say cherry pick, but you figure out how to craft your narrative in a way that highlights the data points that you want to highlight, that highlights either the history or highlights the future potential, and then really leans into that and magnifies it. So you figure out how to get this all linked together where you're crafting not only what's happened, but you're also telling during that same time where you're going. And I think it's one of the reasons that investors really like listening to a company's public earnings call, because in that call, not only is the leadership team talking about the last 3 months and what happened, because that's usually posted, you know, an hour before, 2 hours before an earnings call. So, you know, that's live data. It's already out there. It's already hit the press. It's already Edgarized, so you can already pull it. But what they're really interested in is leadership's tone. Where's the company going? How confident are they in the results that they're guiding to? And I think that is really where, you know, a company can show up strong, you know, consistently show up with a really good story quarter over quarter. And then they develop a history and a reputation of either, you know, under-promising and over-delivering, or over-promising and under-delivering. So then you end up starting to read through that narrative in relation to their kind of history. But that's where the power comes, is from really being able to craft, I think, where you're going a little bit and have the user focus on that and not just the last 3 months.
So let's have a worked example here. So I, you know, frequently get people reaching out and for some sort of investment or whatever, they want to see the accounts, right? So they want to see, hey, where are you at? Or, you know, we're getting into discussions over different things. So I normally just sort of pull them out of the accounts, send them over, and 9 times out of 10 goes nowhere, right? So you saying that actually I'm missing a trick there. I shouldn't be doing that. I should be, say, getting someone who can help me present that. People want to be sold. That's what I'm hearing here. People want to be sold. They don't want to just see a bunch of numbers. They actually want to make it easier for them. They want someone to put that story together, at least the best case of what the story could be.
Yeah, and I think that's where it depends on who the users are of those accounts, of those statements. So, you know, if you're sending that to a potential investor, like, yeah, I think they're going to want to know your history. And to the same point, if you're sending it to a bank, a creditor or surety, and you're looking to get them to sign off, you know, and cover you if in the event something goes wrong, like if you want them to be that guarantor, then I think you are going to get a lot further by building a relationship with that person. And by doing that, you're probably going to end up telling them where you came from, where you're at, where you're going. You're going to share your story. You're going to share your budget to actual and kind of how you know where your shortcomings are and how you know what you're working on. So I think the best people out there, they are measuring their results against something so that they can measure a trend. And then as they look at that trend, they can then focus on, you know, hey, what are my near-term strategic goals that I need to hit so that I can make sure that I'm hitting my long-term goals? And that's what the game is all about. It's about breaking out a long game into that short game that's repetitive.
Very good. All right. So let's move on then to talk about fund accounting, if you like. So let's start with the basics. So what is fund accounting? What do they teach you in school about it?
I think school teaches you a lot of theory, right? And I think in practice, you learn a lot of the practical why. So I think in school, you're taught, you know, fund accounting basics, and that's a separate fund used for restricted purposes. And, you know, you're kind of taught how to reconcile that. If you take it back to the basics, for anybody that even doesn't know what that concept is, you can think of your balance sheet and your P&L, you know, in a regular for-profit company where you might have one column for that year. But we're actually going to throw in at least two columns now if you've got fund accounting in play, because you're generally going to have a unrestricted fund where the company or the organization can use that for, you know, its mission, its purpose, whatever its purposes are. And then you're going to have another column that's usually restricted for some sort of purpose for some reason. And we'll get more into that. And then you have a total. So, you know, as you have revenue and expense in each fund, just like you do in a for-profit company, you need to make sure that equity rolls from the prior period. So now you need to do that at two different levels. You need to do that at each fund level, and you need to do it in total. So it just adds a little bit of complexity in how things are showing up. But now if you've got that visual, I think the real key purpose of it and what's driving it is the need for transparency. So I'm probably getting a little bit further ahead, James, than you want me to
because you said some stuff there that I'm catching up on. So you said that you have two columns. I can kind of see that in my mind's eye, a bit like you might have, let's say, divisions in a company or something. So I want to see some kind of a cost accounting type of thing, I guess. But you said something else there. You have to track it down to how it affects equity on the balance sheet.
Like when you have fund accounting, a lot of the time your equity accounts are actually titled net asset accounts, and you'll have your net asset accounts could be unrestricted, where it's, you know, for the organization's purpose and they can use it for, you know, management salaries or mow the lawn. And then you might have donor restricted net assets, and that's tracked in a donor restricted fund. And those donor restricted funds could be restricted for various purposes, such as, you know, constructing a building or investing in a certain area of that organization or serving a certain population that organization serves. So then for the organization to use those funds, say a donor provides, you know, say you give $1 million to a nonprofit and you say, hey, nonprofit, I want you to use this $1 million to go buy of land and building, and I want you to use this $1 million to start a capital campaign. So what can you do with that?
Okay. So you mentioned nonprofits there. I guess this is where it crops up most frequently. You're getting money from, you know, donors, and they say, okay, I want my James E. Kennedy wing at the university, and I just want my name on it, and you're to use it for that and nothing else. Does that come from some sort of charter or constitution about what's restricted and not? Like, where are the rules set up for that?
Yeah. And I think when you're focused on nonprofits, a lot of those rules are donor focused. So to have a restricted fund now in GAAP, US GAAP anyway, you need to have a external factor that's introducing that restriction. So it would be, you know, a government sometimes in the case of a government contract to a nonprofit, maybe it's for a specific purpose that they need to use those governmental funds for, or it could be a donor that says, hey, nonprofit organization, you need to use these funds for a specific purpose. But I guess it's not just nonprofits though, it's also governmental. So fund accounting dates back, you know, way before just nonprofits, FASB codified it and all that. But it dates back, you know, to medieval Europe, I think, and it goes back to taxes. It goes back to how funds were collected and spent. And governments use it now. Like you could think of a general fund for a county where you might live or reside. And, you know, that general fund is tracking how, you know, general property tax dollars are used. But then there's sometimes special revenue funds, there's bond funds. There ends up being all these other special purpose funds on these governmental statements that all aggregate up into these government-wide statements. And what a user is getting, which a lot of the cases is the taxpayer, is they're getting clarity on sources and uses of funds by intent or by purpose. And it's all about enhancing that transparency. And then if we end real quick, flipping back to that nonprofit, because if you can show that donor really clearly in your external statements, these are what you told me I was able to use, this is how I used it, that organization is going to get increased trust, is going to gain increased trust from that donor. And that donor is going to be willing to open up their pocket, willing to open up their pocket a little bit more. And then also they're going to be able to use that, those statements to be able to go get, you know, additional sources of funds.
Okay, well, let me just close off on the tactical piece a little bit. So to be able to do this tactically, like day to day, like is QuickBooks good enough, or do you need specialist software, or is it done on a spreadsheet, or what's the way of keeping everything straight?
Yeah, you know, we're still a newer firm. So, you know, we do service a lot of the newer kind of upcoming nonprofit organizations, maybe going through their first audit. And we see a wide varied range. You know, some have specialized nonprofit accounting software. Some don't. Some are using QuickBooks. They're using QuickBooks by class. Some are using a spreadsheet, and then they're engaging with another accounting firm. And then that accounting firm is taking that spreadsheet and putting it into the QuickBooks for them. So everyone evolves at a different speed. But I think that the need to do this is there's an external restriction that you need to track, and or, you know, you're just setting up a clean accounting process that's going to grow with the organization as you scale. Yeah, okay, those are kind of the two core needs.
Yeah, I'm smiling because I've seen one of those spreadsheets before. You get the spreadsheet and you see the restricted, unrestricted. One's in one font and the other one's in a different font. And you clearly see they've been like sort of, you know, one's using commas and one's using whatever decimals and all the rest. So, yeah, it gets hairy out there, I guess, is what you're saying. So, okay, now let's move on then to like the purpose of this. You touched on a little bit, but like, why go through all this trouble? I get it. Like, I'm giving money on my James E. Kennedy wing. I want it only spent on the James E. Kennedy wing. Is it as simple as that? Or is it just like, what do they call it? Is it just paperwork? Like, what's the higher purpose for getting this right?
I think the higher purpose is being able to use this as a, you know, if you strip back the strict technical and the compliance nature of it, I think it's being able to use this as a tool for your organization to craft your storytelling. So a lot of people are going to say it's compliance, this and that, but look at it as a tool. Look at it as a way to say, hey, look, world, look at this amazing thing that we've done with these donor restricted funds. We've taken their $2 million. We've used it for its intended purpose. We bought a land and building, we moved our organization into it. And now because of that, we've grown our organization and now we're serving a larger percentage of the population. We're seeing a lot of nonprofits that in this day and age, they want to include a lot of, you know, mission driven data, a lot of non-financial data and trends and metrics in their financials. And I think as these organizations really spend and use these donor restricted funds for their intended purposes, a lot of the time they're going to start to amplify the amount of individuals that they're serving. So I think use it for that purpose. Don't just use it for the compliance. Like, yes, it's there to, you know, make sure that we're in compliance with GAAP because the FASB says that we have to. But I think that if you use it in a strategic way, it's really going to empower that organization's leadership to use it in a way to go out and secure, you know, additional funding, to secure additional projects, and really secure that organization's future for itself.
Okay. So who's in your experience, or have you seen do this really well that don't just do it as a paperwork exercise, but have managed to leverage it to, let's say, bring it back into their marketing or drive more revenue?
You know, when I think of some of the larger nonprofits in town, like I'm up in the Seattle area, so we've got a nonprofit in town, Food Lifeline, and they get a lot of food donated from like the Costco's, the Walmart's, the grocers, you know, that might not be shelf quality, but it's still great food. So that'll get donated, and other product and merchandise will go to them. And they do a really good job, I think, at marketing themselves in the organization as, you know, number of families served with those pounds of food or number of meals served. And they'll distribute that food to the organization. And it's really interesting kind of how the whole ecosystem works, because we actually have an audit client that ends up getting food donated or gleaned from Food Lifeline. So you get to see the whole ecosystem sometimes on really how big it really is. But, you know, I think they're one where they market pretty well, and they take that financial, you know, they take that financial data and they really boil it down into number of individuals served in terms of meals. And when you go to volunteer there, like we've gone to volunteer there a couple times when I was at Starbucks, and they break down the weight of the food that you've kind of sorted, and then they break that down into a number of meals, and you leave as a volunteer knowing that you made an impact in somebody's life that day, because they're going to get food on the table.
Interesting. Okay, well, I like this because this is something proactive, right, that the finance function can bring actually as a value add, that can add value, maybe revenue to the business that wouldn't be available otherwise, right? So there's all sorts of demands on people's giving these days, or maybe even more than that these days with the waste, fraud, and abuse that's going on. You know, maybe it's becoming more relevant than ever to be able to justify and stand over. You get that dreaded email from Elon asking you what your organization did last week, and you're able to say, hey, I've been fund accounting, no problem, here you go, click click, here are the line items, so read them and weep, Elon. Yeah. All right, very good. Tell me a bit about, you mentioned nonprofits or people who are in this. Is this a particular expertise or an area you're interested in working in? And if someone's listening to this, you know, who should reach out to you, and how can they do that?
Yeah, no, good question. I think we love nonprofit accounting. It's unique, it's complicated, but then there's also an impact, right? So not only are we getting to help, you know, somebody with their financial statements, but we're also getting to help an organization execute its mission. And it's really fun getting to help an organization grow. And at our size, you know, the key person to be reaching out to us is that smaller to medium-sized nonprofit, you know, anywhere from, say, a couple million in revenue up to about 100 million in revenue, you know, that needs an audit, a review, 990, maybe interim fractional CFO support. Maybe you're going through a leadership transition and you just need somebody to keep the ship up and help you with the search. You know, we can come in and we'll help you interview and backfill and train, and then we'll fade out into the sunset. And then on the other side of nonprofits, we specialize in construction contractors. So that's another area of accounting that's somewhat complex, and they have some nuances, and we like nuances. So, you know, scheduling a WIP schedule, work in process schedule for completed contracts, uncompleted contracts, percent complete, all that. We like that. So any construction contractor that needs a better relationship with their surety, you can get that through better financial statements. So reach out if you need bonding capacity.
You said something I didn't understand there. What's a surety, and why would you want a better relationship with it?
Yeah, surety, you can think of it like a broker for your insurance company. So they're helping a construction contractor a lot of the times get a construction build bond. And what that does is that gives the owner insurance, and it says that if James doesn't execute and build my house like I expect him to, then that insurance company is going to bring in another contractor to build James's house. Contractors a lot of the times have a certain capacity, and their insurance company will let them have, say, $5 million in bid bonds outstanding. And that means that they can go after $5 million of work at one time. But as that contractor grows and scales and proves that they can do larger and larger jobs, they need to, in turn, prove financial transparency to that insurance company. So that insurance company will increase that $5 million limit to $10 million, to $15 million, to $20 million as that contractor grows.
Interesting. All right. Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. If you come this far into the show, your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. You can sign up for a newsletter. Why would you want to be on our newsletter, I hear you think? Well, I'll give you three very good reasons. We've started identifying recent examples of waste, fraud and abuse in the news and collecting them. Some of them, I'll be honest, are for entertainment value. We had Naomi Campbell in there a couple of weeks ago because what she was up to do with her charity, actually, funny enough, she wasn't doing her fund accounting properly and got caught out for flying people around people first class when she should have been helping starving artists, all the way up to municipalities. And we all know that municipalities can get in trouble with how they manage their funds. So if you're interested slash curious, have a morbid interest into these things, sign up for the newsletter. Maybe you'll learn something which may keep you out of the newsletter in future. And I'd say there might be a lesson for you in there. I'd also like to dovetail out here. We also love working with charities. Actually, I went to a trip to the States last year. My first meeting was with D.E. Shaw. They're the largest, most successful hedge fund in the world, and they're a customer of ours. And my second meeting was an orphanage in Southern Texas. And it was a great juxtaposition. But the working with these nonprofits is something that we do a lot of. We work with orphanages, with educational, Arkansas School for the Deaf, lots and lots of very worthwhile organizations. And we help them deliver some of the benefits that we've been talking about here today. So that's it, Nick. This has been a very natural, enjoyable conversation. Thank you very much for coming along today.
Yeah. Thanks, James, for the time.